As you'll be aware, Greece is in a lot of trouble. Its economy is cactus, there's been another political crisis, and they are in the unfortunate position of having to borrow from Peter to pay Paul. The government needs an extra 12 billion euros from the EU in order just to avoid defaulting on their debt repayment next month. Now, unless you're going on holiday to Greece or you have relatives there, you might be wondering why you should care. But everything is connected. If Greece fails, there could be a domino effect that you and I end up feeling here. To talk about this and the exorbitant price of bananas, I'm joined by the two economists, Oliver Hartwich from the libertarian think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies, and David Hetherington from the progressive one, Per Capita. Gentlemen, welcome.
Morning, Richard.
Hello, Richard.
Why should we worry about Greece, Oliver?
Because we have seen that in a globalized world, there are no local problems anymore. Whatever happens on the other side of the planet matters here. We have seen it with the global financial crisis when American banks went under and when American mortgages were no longer repaid. And that had implications in Europe, in Asia, in Australia. So once again, we're seeing a story that's happening somewhere far away in Greece, in a small country, and yet it does still matter here.
But America's a vast country with a huge economy. Greece is a relatively small economy, which is actually plugged into a big, rich club. Can't this just be handled in-house?
Well, you would hope so, but unfortunately it is a small country, but it is a country that is interconnected in Europe, and a lot of European banks, especially French banks, have a lot of investments outstanding in Greece. And the other problem is, of course, that if Greece goes under, there is at least a fear that it might spread to other countries, and we've already seen it spread to countries like Ireland and Portugal. And there are other indebted countries in Europe, of course, like Spain, Italy, Belgium. So who knows where this is going to end? Is Greece just the canary in the coal mine, if you like?
David?
The problem is really the fear of the unknown. So no one knows what will happen if Greece does default on its debt over the next 6 or 12 months. The worst case scenario is that the psychology of the financial markets leads to a kind of a freezing up of liquidity, which means that banks will stop lending to each other, stop lending to businesses, which is what happened immediately after Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008. So the biggest fear is that you get that freezing up of credit markets. That might not happen, but the reason everyone's so concerned is no one knows what the knock-on effect will be. The best case scenario is that some European banks take a haircut, that they take some losses. Maybe one or two would fall over. That should be manageable. The bigger problem is that kind of ripple through contagion effect around fear.
Yeah. And if you get, Oliver mentioned Italy, if it gets to, Italy's a substantial economy. It's quite a lot bigger
Italy
than Greece.
I actually had a conversation with an Italian politician last year about this, and their attitude is, funnily enough, that if it gets to Italy, the problems will be so big that we'll be talking about a completely different world, a completely different financial universe, because there's a kind of domino effect whereby Portugal, Ireland and Spain all rank before Italy in terms of how close they are to the precipice. If those go over, and you know, Spain is not a small economy either, then Europe's problems and consequently the world's problems will be so great that, you know, we'll be talking about solutions of an entirely different.
But as I understand your position, David, this is just one overseas or external problem that could impact on us. You're also concerned about America and even worried about China.
That's true. So some of the numbers out of America in the last quarter suggest that they might be going into a double-dip recession. That's not a certainty at this point, but American employment numbers don't look great. American growth doesn't look great. Consumer confidence in America is low. So if they go into a double-dip recession, that's very bad for kind of global demand, given that they're still the world's biggest economy. China has an inflation problem, or the beginnings of an inflation problem that people are concerned about. So if China has a kind of an asset price bubble like we saw in the West in the mid-2000s, that has its own set of ramifications. My concern for Australia is that we have convinced ourselves, I believe, that we are on the cusp of resource boom mark two, that we are going into a kind of a new golden age in terms of all the minerals that we have to export offshore. But if the end consumers of those minerals, if the end consumers of those resources...
The
people who buy stuff from China hiccup, then, you know, that'll have a flow-through effect on us. And I don't think we've thought through the consequences of that fully.
David, Oliver, I mean, are you buying this? I mean, the Reserve Bank Governor, Glenn Stevens, made a point last week of saying we all benefit from the resources boom and essentially get ready for higher interest rates sooner or later.
I think he's right. Sure, we benefit from the resources boom. In Australia would be an infinitely poorer country without resources, no doubt about that. But I think David is right, because there are still other risks around. And I think the world's biggest risk at the moment is public debt. And if you look at the levels of public debt, not just in Greece, but all across Europe and America and Japan, for example, the figures are frightening. And you have to ask yourself, what are the long-term consequences of all of this? I can only see three. Either countries go under and default eventually, and I think for some countries that's almost a mathematical certainty, or you will see periods of inflation, and we are already seeing the beginnings of that in Britain, for example, where inflation is already at close to 5%, or we do something about debt now and try to reduce debt loads, but that's going to be very, very difficult.
That's what Ross Garnaut would call a diabolical public policy problem, I think.
That's right, and just on Oliver's last point about doing something about debt now, I was fortunate enough, if you can call it that, to sit through a presentation by the Greek Prime Minister a few weeks ago. And he said over the last 12 months, and they're trying to reduce their debt as we speak, over the last 12 months they've closed 3,000 schools, they've closed 400 TAFEs, or their equivalents, and just to kind of put the icing on the cake, they received 90,000 asylum seekers into Greece in the first quarter of this year, which are 90,000 people who have to be fed, sheltered, transported, managed. So this is a diabolical problem. The other thing I'd say about sitting through the presentation from the Greek PM was that of the 150-odd people in the room, I don't think one person there believed his pitch that Greece could save and earn itself out of this predicament. I think everybody thinks Greece is going to default. They might end up calling it something different, but Greece is going to default in the next 12 or 18 months.
All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about bananas, Oliver. A banana and a half these days will get you a decent flat white. You think we're paying way too much for them?
Yeah, I recently visited Germany and
Of bananas.
Home of bananas, of course. Home of the great German banana industry.
In the south, isn't it? Around Munich, there's these great great hillsides full of bananas.
Yeah, it's all yellow and it's... anyway... no, actually, I was surprised. I mean, Germany, of course, doesn't quite have the same kind of banana growing industry as Australia has, but banana prices are cheaper. I saw them in a North German...
How are banana prices cheaper in a country that has to import them from elsewhere in the world?
That's precisely the point, because the Germans still import them and the Australians don't. In Australia, you will basically only find Australian bananas on the shelves. And that's why we're currently paying $12, $13 a kilo, because, of course, we had Yasi and we had floods in Queensland, and the Australian banana crop was, I think, 75% of it were destroyed. Mm. Now, the Germans still import bananas from the world market, so they don't have to worry about that, because the world market price has barely moved and shifted after Yasi. And so they are still getting bananas for the equivalent of about $1 a kilo. So whenever you're going to an Australian supermarket now and you're buying bananas for $13 a kilo, basically you're paying $12 for protection.
David, can't we get other inferior bananas from other places and... Because now they've become a kind. This is Australia's favourite fruit for years and years and years.
And you know, they are kind of an icon of the national economic health.
They're kind of, now you pick up a banana, you know it's worth at least $2. I mean, people are not eating as many bananas. Why can't we have some imported ones?
Well, the long answer, and I won't use all of it, is that, you know, Australia's been pretty good in terms of trade liberalisation over the last 20 years. We've been one of the leading countries embracing the WTO processes and the Doha round. But there are certain sectors of our economy that haven't yet been touched by trade liberalisation for a set of reasons. Now, there are people who will argue that for the health of our national crops in terms of kind of biohazards and things like that, we need to restrict imports of certain fruits for risk of contaminating our domestic crop. I'm not a scientist, I can't comment on that, but it would be healthier for the Australian consumer if we were able to import bananas in times of crisis like this.
And not just bananas, by the way. I think it's true for used cars as well, because it's almost impossible to import a used car into Australia. And if I were allowed to import used cars, say, from Britain, I think it would save about 30% on the price of my next car.
I hear what Oliver's saying, but we shouldn't overshadow the kind of bigger point, which is that Australia is a pretty open economy by all measures. We're not highly protected in the way that the French agricultural sector, for example,
is. I'm an avid reader of Oliver's prodigious output in writing, and he makes the point about bananas, alcohol, accommodation, public transport, cars all cheaper in Germany. He's not the only person saying this.
You can't trade accommodation.
You can trade cars.
Matt Wade, the Fairfax journalist, just come back from India from being the correspondent there. He says we're paying way too much for telecommunications, broadband, air travel, choice, The Consumers Association says we're paying too much for music, white goods, video games, just to name a few. We're not as open and competitive as we could be.
I'd contest some of those points. I think on white goods, we're an importer primarily of domestic appliances and white goods. We have a very, very high exchange rate. If you look at the CPI figures, the prices of computers, TVs, washing machines, microwaves, these kind of things have consistently gone down over the last 20 years, even before the exchange rate effect. So I think it's possible to overstate that argument.
Okay. On Life Matters today, the two economists are in, David Hetherington from Per Capita and Oliver Hartwich from the Centre for Independent Studies. That's enough economics for now, I think, because I want to ask both of you about something else. The Economist magazine published a survey of Australia a couple of weeks ago. I thought it was excellent, I have to say. One of the things it said is that our politicians are woeful. David, I'll begin with you, but I'll ask you both, actually. What do you think of the quality of public debate and discourse here in Australia?
I think it's deeply depressing. I think the specific quote from The Economist was that our politicians couldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding. I think they're a third of the problem. All of our big long-term debates today are being simplified and dumbed down, really. And I think for whatever reason, I think there's a structural kind of characteristic of our political class that focus groups are more important. There's an unwillingness to take long-term risk. I think that's compounded by two other factors. The media, with a couple of honourable exceptions, likes to simplify and produce kind of entertaining adversarial positions that aren't really to the good of the public debate. And a disturbing recent development is that some sections of the business community now see it as legitimate to advertise widely in the guise of the national interest when what they're really doing is advertising in the guise of their annual profits. And I think those three things have come together in a very damaging way for Australia.
Oliver, you've been here sufficiently a short enough time to still have a fresh perspective. Well,
I don't want to be unnecessarily adversarial, so I'll agree with David here. And
I mentioned honourable exceptions.
I think it is your analysis is absolutely spot on. I think the Economist article really hit the nail on the head. I read it when I was in Germany, and I couldn't agree more with the sentiment that Australian debate could improve quite a bit. And if there was one thing that perhaps reconciled me a little bit with the state of Australian public debate was when I read it in Germany, I thought that German public debates were not better. So I think it is a problem in many developed countries now that the level of political discourse has deteriorated so much, perhaps because of media pressures, but I think Australia is certainly not the exception here.
Can I say, because it annoys and frustrates me, but, I mean, it doesn't really matter if I'm annoyed and frustrated. Is it more serious than annoying and frustrating?
It is. It is, absolutely. And Oliver's right to say that the quality of debate in other wealthy Western democracies has gone in a similar direction because there are similar structural features around focus groups, the entertainment factor in the media and the like, the power of lobbying in the business community. The reason it's more serious in Australia, I think, is that The Economist article points out that we're on the cusp, potentially, of a kind of sea-changing set of fortunate circumstances that we are in a position to either take advantage of and carefully think through and set ourselves up really for generations of prosperity and fairness and a lot of the other good things that I think as a country would want. There's a risk we blow that opportunity if we don't take considered long-term decisions now rather than fighting over, you know, who's going to win the next news poll.
I think the problem for Australia is actually that Australia can afford a lot of bad policy and bad politics because we have the mining sector and we can export our way out of trouble. But that's glossing over the real problems that we're having in political discourse. Other countries don't have that luxury. And I think that makes it even worse and even more depressing.
I think it's possible to say that right at this point in time. And for the last 5-6 years, yes, the mining sector has given us enough money that we can kind of buy our way through these problems. But wouldn't you rather reform in a period of prosperity?
Yeah.
You ask Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain whether they'd rather have done the hard work 10 years ago or have to do it now. And the problem with relying on the mining sector is that it is famously cyclical.
Now, that's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying we're just glossing over some problems, but we're really missing the big picture here.
We'll have to come back to this next time, but I want you both to think about, I'm sure you have, what can we do about it? Because it would be good if we could do something. Thank you once again, gentlemen, for joining me.
Cheers, Richard.
Oliver Hartwich is a research fellow with the Centre for Independent Studies, a libertarian think tank. David Hetherington is executive director of the progressive think tank Per Capita. We have them every month. They are the two economists. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. A bit later on, an extraordinary story from our Meet the Listener guest this week. We're coming up, how to ensure better access for mental health.